Welcome to the Allowed Podcast. I'm Louise Steinman, curator of the Allowed series, presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Allowed is a series of dynamic lectures, readings, performances, and discussions that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. To learn more about Allowed and learn how you can help the Library Foundation of Los Angeles support the Los Angeles Public Library, please go to our website, www.alloudla.org. The Allowed program you're about to hear was produced in 2009. I'm going to introduce Michael Silverblatt, who will be introducing Azar. Michael is the host and guiding spirit of KCRW's half-hour radio show, Bookworm. I'm sure many of you, how many people here have heard Michael Silverblatt? Yes. Where he introduces listeners to new and emerging authors along with writers of renown. His formidable knowledge comes from close reading and an analysis of a writer's entire oeuvre. Susan Sontag called him a national treasure. He's certainly a Los Angeles treasure as well. He's a New York native, graduated from the State University of New York in Buffalo, and took advanced courses at Johns Hopkins. He moved to Los Angeles in the mid-1970s, where he worked in motion picture, public relations, and script development. He created Bookworm for KCRW FM in 1989. Allowed considers Michael a great friend, and we are all very lucky to have him as part of LA's literary community. Not just a part of it, he's a great catalyst and a great champion of Los Angeles's literary community. Please welcome Michael Silverblatt. Thank you.
Watch this. I mean, who wouldn't want to be a member of an organization that has a lectern that does that? I mean, truly. But I do want to say, many of us who have moderated for the library have given our honorariums in whole or in part back to the library to continue this program. I have to tell you a real secret, that it doesn't happen anymore and will not happen without you. We watched a great bookstore, Dutton's, close without support. It doesn't stay open. It is no longer the case that culture exists without supporters. It's true on KCRW. I'm at the fortunate mercy of my listeners. But it's true all over the city. If you are near an independent bookstore, go to the independent bookstore. If you like the library reading series, if everyone here put in $40, you would have the next reader, for sure. But we have to keep doing it. It can't be forgotten. One of the reasons it's relevant to say this is that this first book of Azar Nafisi, Reading Lolita in Tehran, is one of the very few books I know that is eloquent, passionate, and convincing in the advocacy of culture. You know, this is one of the few reading free things we do to have who we are. Whoever writes has come from some place he talks about and makes accessible to you. When Azar Nafisi is reading American and British literature in Tehran, she's talking about... I'll wait. To go into a public place with something like that on really is not polite. Okay. I ask, you know, for as much regard as I'm willing to give you. The world that we live in is changing. Azar Nafisi provides a record of that changing world, its attitudes toward culture, its desire to maintain itself. What's dying in the Iran of reading Lolita in Tehran is the ability to empathize with other cultures. The teachers in the universities where she's teaching are joined in many cases with students saying, why are we reading these books? Why are we reading a book about an adulterer, the Great Gatsby, about a child molester, Lolita? In other words, it's been forgotten worldwide that literature is at the forefront of teaching us how to empathize even with the things we disapprove of, especially with the things we disapprove of. The book is a very beautiful plea to any culture to welcome its culture, its cultural expressions, the opportunity of culture to provide a forum. The new book, Things I've Been Silent About, is a book about family. It's realized suddenly, I think, in reading Lolita in Tehran, that Azar Nafisi presents herself nearly as a saint, or at least I was willing to worship her, and that it had better be the case that she tell us where she came from, that she was not raised as a saint. In fact, she lived with people who were not distinctly saints. She was the beneficiary of those people's interest in education, getting the degree eventually at Oxford. Today, she's a visiting professor and head of the discussion series at the Johns Hopkins University International Institute. It's rather a remarkable career, and I would say that with one book, Reading Lolita in Tehran, Azar Nafisi made an international name for herself by talking about what we were losing wherever we are when we allow culture to come under attack, when we allow bookstores to close, when we say, oh, someone else will support that reading series. I don't have the money this season. We are the only ones who will do it. The ones who are here in this room tonight are the ones who will do it, are the ones who have to. So please think about that, and don't let yourself be a person who lets other people do it. The whole culture system in America is dependent upon not only your seeing your part, but waking everyone else up to see theirs. And with all of that, I would like to welcome Niffar Afizi. Now tell me, first of all, in reference to reading, are they reading Afizi in Tehran?
I don't know. I hope that they are reading Lolita in Tehran. I hope they're reading Hannah Arendt in Tehran. I hope they're reading Ferdowsi and Rumi in Tehran. I don't think it matters that much whether they're reading Azar Nafisi in Tehran.
Well, it does matter, because I think you make an argument that's rarely made. That is to say, there's been a division, it seems to me, in the love of literature. Something happened. On the one hand, we had a very difficult kind of theoretical approach to literature that is the opposite, say, of Edmund Wilson. My parents could read The New Yorker and understand Edmund Wilson. They wouldn't be able to understand Agamben or Derrida. It's a different world. And so someone who speaks in a human language about the importance of literature, it seems to me, is writing an important book.
Well, you know, reading Lolita in Tehran happens in Iran, and the subject matter is Iran. But it's also a reaction to the kind of life I was leading in the United States when I came here. Iran is the place where it happens, but the whole point of the book is the way fiction creates spaces under repressive conditions. What I was amazed when I came here was the fact that people would think that this sort of fiction would only work in a repressive society. You know, you're here in the only place where your identification, your passport, is not dependent on nationality or ethnicity or religion or gender or sex. It is in a place like this, where a man called Rumi can live side by side with a woman called Emily Dickinson, with a man called Goethe, with a woman called Zora Neale Hurston. And the whole passport to this world is curiosity and empathy. You take that away from it, you take away how people feel and how people connect. What have you got left? So, you know, we're bailing out Saks Fifth Avenue. The question, I think, in front of us tonight is, who will bail out imagination and thought? Who is going to do it?
Well, do you think there is a way? I'm curious how you came to be teaching English and American literature in Iran.
Well, my cousin Majid and my uncle and aunt are sitting over there, and they can tell you, first of all, in our family, I mean, I mention it in my book, that the idea, love of literature started with my father. He would tell me stories, and he began telling the stories with stories from our great epic poet, Ferdowsi. And time and again, there would be this discussion that this is an ancient culture, and it has been ravaged and destroyed many times over. And the only thing that has kept the idea of Iran alive, the only thing that has given it continuity is its poetry. Is this mythology and history that Ferdowsi wove and Hafez in another way, gave to us. And the image that we have of ourselves, the best could come out of our poetry. But one other thing he did, and I was again surprised when I came to this country, how segregated culture has become. Like, if you're an Iranian woman coming from a country that is now just known as Muslim without defining what Muslim means, everybody told me, great, you have a great opportunity to go into women's studies and teach, Islamic literature. I said, no, you go to women's studies and teach Islamic literature, because the whole idea of literature and thought is about the other. It is about a man named Dick Davis, who is a British poet teaching at Ohio State University, translating Ferdowsi and Ghorghani. And someone from Iran, a young girl who has never left the Islamic Republic of Iran, read Nabokov in English and talk about Nabokov in a way that maybe her English peers would not. You know, that is the whole idea of literature. It is about the other. It is investigation of the stranger, that intimate stranger within you and without. And so my father, and in our family, and they can tell me if I'm wrong, there was no boundaries. I mean, you would jump from Ferdowsi into, when I was a kid, into Pinocchio, into Hans Christian Andersen, into Little Prince. When we grew up and were a little more intellectual, then you would jump into from Hedayat into Sartre and into Camus. There were no boundaries. That was one republic where I could enter and come and go. And fiction became my obsession. And some of the best fiction, the father and mother of fiction, is English, especially 18th and 19th century.
Now, I'm curious how reading is taught in Iran, because here in America, something terrible happened. I was shown a book from as late as the 1950s, a elementary school book, and it had stories for second, third, fourth graders by Edgar Allan Poe, poems by Wordsworth, poems by John Russell Lowell, essays by Emerson, things that now we would say a second grader could never read. Why would we say this now? Because a second grader reads Run, Dog, Run, See, Dog, Run, 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 Run. And then we wonder why people grow up without loving reading. The thing about reading is you don't understand it the first time. You read it again and again and again, and you watch it grow before your very eyes as you watch yourself grow. And you would never read Run, Dog, Run again. How was reading taught elsewhere?
Well, first of all, the whole idea of reading, it is a very sensual experience. Because the first thing that reading does, if it's going to put you into the experience of another person, that means that you have to feel, your heart has to beat with to the rhythm of another's heart. And you have to walk, you have to touch. Nabokov talks to his students that, you know, when he talks about Anna Karenina, he's not talking theory. He's not making her vanish, you know, by showing himself up. He talks about the texture of her coat. You know, the feel of that is what makes Anna immortal. Because as Witold Gombrowicz, the Polish critique, says, we are persons, we are personalities, we're not abstract thoughts, you know. And so that is what is vanishing from us, because I think either O'Reilly and Obermann are taking over, or, you know, Run, Dog, Run. They're both on the same level. But in Iran, officially, reading is really maybe not very much encouraged, because reading is memorization. I mean, you had to memorize Hafiz. And of course, it did me good, because Hafiz, being pure poetry, the rhythm and, you know, the way the words sit together, you have to feel before you understand the meaning. And you know, making me memorize maybe helped me in that way. But the authority told you what to get out of Hafiz. And maybe, in a sense, it was good, because people in the privacy of their homes would read for pleasure. And they would connect with the book for pleasure. And I think that that is what we have to think about now, seriously, in this country, you know.
I want to go back to what you said about reading and sensuality, because I know that the first book by Nabokov that you were given by your husband, it was Ada. And
not by my husband, by my boyfriend, but if you want to make me chaste, that's it. You can say that.
I didn't say the person who slept with you was your husband. I said no. It was your first Nabokov.
Yeah, but the truth is that his name was Ted.
Azar has written a book of criticism about Ada. But what I remember in particular, if someone asked me to say my favorite sentence in Ada, Van, who is the hero, has gotten his first kiss from his cousin, Ada. They are, despite concealments of genealogy, first cousins. They are incestuous lovers. And he says, as he tastes her tongue, a fresh boiled strawberry, still hot. And who can't feel that texture or remember it the first time we tasted such a strawberry? And that is what literature does for me, makes the experience that is universal unforgettable.
Literature, I think, restores our name to ourselves. Saul Bellow used to say that what threatens this the democratic societies is their sleeping consciousness and an atrophy of feeling. And I love that idea, that atrophy of feeling. Over here, you live with sensations, but not with sensuality. And the way to restore that sensuality is through things that endure. You become layered. Because when W.S. Merwin, as a poet, is imbued with, you know, all the other poets that came before him, there is the weight of history, the weight of living in the language that poetry uses. And so you connect to the past, you become alive to the present, and you can predict or foresee or imagine the future. And I always thought about America. I thought the idea of America was a very poetic idea, to imagine what already doesn't exist and to actualize it. And nowadays we keep talking about Lincoln. We keep talking about Martin Luther King. We talk about founding fathers. That language is so layered. Those people were so imbued with the knowledge of their times. I mean, you know, you begin a social political movement by having a dream, for heaven's sake. You know, so are we inheritors of Lincoln? Are we genuinely having a conversation with the past, or are we using Lincoln the way some of us in Iran use Ferdowsi to talk about the glorious past because we're losing the glorious present? You know, that is what worries me. And in my new book reading, that is what I wanted to talk about. Past is always alive, and you need to converse with it, and you need to contribute to it, and we're losing it. This is just as important as Goldman Sachs going broke. Those bloody businessmen were the ones who told us, don't send your children to liberal arts colleges, that your children need to go and make more money. They taught their children to come to literature in classes and say, why Great Gatsby? Look where they got us. And our politicians were the ones who forgot that a country named Iraq was once called Mesopotamia. It was once the cradle of civilization. You don't liberate a people, you give voice to them. You help their voices be heard. So look at where they got us. What are we going to do about it? Are we going to just protest by going and, you know, protesting, you know, against George Bush? No. We have to have a march on Washington where we'll have a national dialogue about what is happening to our imagination and thought. And I think you can start it, Michael. I think we make Bookworm the place where we go. And
I'm willing. If you'll come with me, I'll get...
let's go.
This came in the back room. No. I'd really be happy to... Bookworm has been on for 20 years. It is amazing, especially proud that in a city like Los Angeles that is supposed across the country to be famous for its indifference to literature, you've supported the most literary program that has ever existed in America and supported it for 20 years, and I thank you. But there are many writers, and if we could, I mean, you're there in Washington, D.C. If we could find a way together to address the administration, I would call Annie Proulx. I would call all of the writers who people are listening to and talking about. None of us don't want to have this conversation. None of us don't want to initiate it. Because one of the things that Azar points out in things I've been silent about, and no one can call me a bad interviewer because my job is to direct attention back to the guest, is that at a certain point at the university, there were so many demonstrations that people were no longer going to classes, they were going to the demonstration, and eventually there were so many attacks and beatings and arrests that consciousness fell asleep. You know, it is not only the fact that we are living in difficult cultural times, it's that our inertness, we have gotten used to boredom and to be roused. Do you know what being roused would be? Being roused would be two-thirds of you here putting something in an envelope to make sure the series doesn't die tonight.
Well... our libraries are falling apart, and you know, in my book, in the last part, the revolution part, I have this conversation with, in fact, my cousin, because he's here, I want to say something about him. Majid was a child prodigy. He started writing poems at an age where nobody believed that he was writing those poets. And, you know, pride of family, our family, if you can call them called snobs, they're cultural snobs. You know, if somebody doesn't read, then, you know, they're just Never mind. Anyway, that's another story. But that is what he was. And, you know, he was at the center of attention of the group of intellectuals in Isfahan who had a lot of influence all over Iran. And then, like me and some of our other crazy cousins, we became so involved in politics that he put aside writing poetry. And he said that he will not write poetry until the proletarian revolution. As they say, do not ever, you know, wish that what you wish for comes true. Here was a revolution. And Majid, every time he sees me, he says, what have you done for revolution? Of course, I was becoming more and more bourgeois, and I was teaching Gatsby. If you allow me, can I go on with the story?
Please.
He fell in love with an amazing woman whom I never had a chance to see. And they were comrades in arms. And there is a scene in the book where I describe it through his eyes, where he writes about how they would ride on motorcycles with his sister and her husband. And they would go and find cocktail Molotovs, and they were part of the group that liberated the most notorious jail in Tehran at the time, the Evin prison. So he opened the doors of the prisons, and he said that something to the effect that Ferdowsi says at the end of when the Arab conquest of Iran, that the turban replaced the crown, in fact. Now, just a little bit later, that lovely wife was arrested, and Majid is wandering the streets of Tehran again, but this time trying to hide from those who will also catch him. And she's only 24, and she's executed. And there is a scene, and I'm not going to read it, I'm not going to take it, but I just want to mention this because for people who say it's their culture, as if the culture of an ancient country like Iran is about marriage at the age of 9, you know, and not what these people have suffered and how these people have resisted. She was 24 when she was executed, and she writes in her will about how beautiful, she says that life is beautiful and desirable. Like others, I loved life too. However, there comes a time when one must say goodbye to life. For me, that moment has arrived, and I welcome it. I have no specific bequest. I want only to say that life's beauties are never forgettable. Those who are alive should try to get the most out of their lives. And Majid and her father go to the cemetery, but this is a special kind of cemetery for the damned. People who politically oppose the regime do not get a proper burial. They are buried in mass graves. Baha'is that are a sect that came out of, they are also, you know, they also do not get a burial. And he then, they don't know where Ezzat's grave is. And he says that her father told him that his own way of marking his grave is, it is 8 paces from the gate and 16 paces toward the wall. And he has written a poem about that. I want to end this by saying that he says that he had not written poetry since the early 70s. But 3 days after Ezzat's death, when he went with friends to the Alborz Mountains to pay homage to her, in the evening he was sitting by his brother Mehdi, tears streaming down his face, and he started to write 9 poems for her. I wanted to avenge your death, he writes. I wanted to have you close to me. You spoke to me through the muses. I turned back and told Mehdi, now I understand why early men drew those buffaloes on the Altamira caves. From the moment man became man, he needed to articulate. And the articulation was through those drawings and the word. And that is how Majid turned to poetry. It shouldn't take the death of someone close to us to take us back to poetry.
Thank you. Did you want to introduce Masheed?
He's sitting right over there by my aunt and uncle. Of course, if you knew my aunt and uncle, you would also clap for them, but I don't want to turn this into a family memorial.
But this leads me to an important point, and it's one made again and again in your books. While it is true that life's beauties are unforgettable, what we know to be art is not primarily a celebration of the beauties of life. Many people want that. They would like to go to poetry, especially contemporary poetry, and find the providence in the fall of a sparrow. But what we know is true of art is that it reminds us unforgettably about the imperfections of life. Sometimes it's very difficult to live, and to be reminded that someone else found it equally unbearable 100 years before us, that part of the human condition is to find life difficult and sometimes unbearable. Someone once said to me that she liked listening to my show, but why did I always sound like I was crying? And I said, well, don't you like to cry? She said, not when there's nothing to cry about. And I said, but that's the best time. When there's really something to cry about, you can't help it. When it's a luxury, it's very beautiful. But what we're reminded in these books is that life is imperfect, that literature is about imperfect people, and that the family that you're describing, the mother and father that you're describing, are imperfect, and we must love them in their imperfections.
Yeah, that is, Michael and I were talking early on today, and I was telling him about this philosophy teacher I had, and she told me, if you want to test whether you really love a man, you have to love his dirty socks. I think that is the whole idea of life. The only thing that is absolute is death. Life, we are talking about change, change. Why change? Because life is imperfect, and it's constantly striving towards perfection. It is like that wonderful, those wonderful words in the Declaration of Independence. I was so boggled over when I heard, you know, pursuit of happiness. It is like a Jane Austen novel, you know. Happiness is, once you gain happiness, you're dead. You know, where do you go from there? Once you reach perfection, why live? Because the whole idea of discovery, the whole idea behind science and literature and thought is that there are things that we don't know, there are things that we need to perfect. So I knew when I wrote this book that a lot of people, most probably in my family as well as my countrymen and others, will say, how could you? But the whole idea was that I could not write love them if I did not acknowledge that I love them because and despite of their imperfections. I wanted to take away the bitterness out of a relationship by acknowledging that they were perfect and I love them and I miss them. And I don't want the pain to go away. You know, in this culture nowadays, we want closure. We read literature as aspirin. Memoirs have become how-tos. Don't read this because it's not a how-to. I'm not going to show the way out, but I hope that I will show part of the way in. You know, and the whole idea is not closure. Pain is something to be confronted and to be dealt with. Pain is part of life. But the idea is understanding. Understanding the imperfections and allowing other people to live in your heart despite their imperfections. So that was the larger, more universal message, although particularly it's about this family.
And as well, it seems to me that, how to put it, in the path of a writer, it seems that at the beginning of the path, there's the obligation to, in some way, rename yourself. I'm thinking of wrestling with the angel and Jacob being renamed Yisrael. But I'm thinking also of the way it's said about young writers that the first book is the biographical one. In other words, there's the night of terrible truth where you write about what you know. And I don't know if you've ever been a child, but childhood is awful. It was Goethe, I believe, who said, we have all had unhappy childhoods. And it's as if we have to reveal that before we gain access to the realm of the imagination. So I wondered whether this book, Things I've Been Silent About, becomes for you the prelude to writing what I know to be a great dream and desire of yours, a first novel.
That would be giving myself too much credit. But I think that had I not written it, I would have stopped. There would be a dead end. Because every book you write is an opening. It is a closing on something that you have finished, but it's an opening. I wrote Leading Lolita in Tehran the ideas came to me when I was writing about Nabokov, and I didn't want to be just a literary critic. I want to talk about, my experiences every time I read Nabokov, and actually I had to acknowledge that the first book given to me by on Nabokov was Ada by my boyfriend Ted, who wrote on the flyleaf to Azar, my Ada would love Ted. I couldn't do that. And so I opened title in my diary. We are a great family for writing diaries and writing letters to one another. My uncle Reza, when I was leaving for England the first time, he wrote me a whole notebook filled with different poets that were favorites of his and favorites of mine, handwritten. I still have that with a note at the beginning. And so I wrote in my diary under the heading Things I Have Been Silent About. And I wrote about executions and political matters, but I also wrote falling in love in Tehran, watching Marx Brothers in Tehran, leading Lolita in Tehran. And then I also, it was my diary, so I would write about all these secrets that are now in this book. And so both Reading Lolita and Things I Have Been Silent About came out of Nabokov. They're siblings, their birth certificate, they share the same birth certificate. And so with this book, I hope that there will be another path opening up.
Well, it's very interesting to me because I do kind of keep track. You remember how the birds and the forest creatures helped Cinderella make her dress? This is before the godmother came and turned it truly splendid. But one of the pleasures of reading Nazar Hafizi is to realize that the world, her world, conspired with her to get her to write a book. That is to say, her mother, even this mother of whom we have not yet spoken, who is often, very much an obstacle that has to be moved aside before a czar can accomplish anything. The mother must be dealt with.
That is familiar to many of you here.
But the mother gives her a copy of all those articles about literature that a czar has not kept. Magically, one of the students who's been throughout the book so busily taking notes and writing things down has written down every word of the lectures and gives her a transcription beautifully printed, of all the lectures she's given about American literature and British literature. I mean, imagine having, you know, we all speak unplanned. Imagine having someone like the elves who fix the shoes for the cobblers at night, someone giving us our words put together for us, someone who cared enough. A writer is also someone who mobilizes the magic inherent in the world so that the world gives you what you need to write.
You know, that reminded me of a quotation from Margaret Atwood. They asked her, why do you write? And she said, I don't know. There are voices from distant villages beckoning. There is a bloody cleaver in the middle of the living room. And I say, what is that bloody cleaver doing there? It needs to be investigated. You know, and so, as you say, the world puts certain objects, certain themes, certain ideas in front of your eyes, but they're stripped. And you need to investigate. You need to go in and find out, who is that? What is happening? What are those voices? And the more you get into it, the more those voices become alive. Even when you're writing about yourself, you look at yourself partly as a stranger.
Well, it's also, there seems to be a progress in the book. You say in Lolita that the articles you've written, that although you acknowledge that they're the product of hard work, that they are not sensual and passionate the way real work should be. And then you go on to write Reading Lolita, and that is a certain kind of abstract aesthetic passion, but we must strip ourselves bare. And things I've been silent about is about becoming, making oneself raw enough to be speaking, able to speak of anything that might be spoken of. In other words, when you write, to write a truly passionate book, you must be willing to go anywhere at all that you do not want to go. You must be able to force yourself into the dark corners. And that's what I think this book is about.
Because, you know, the whole idea is that you can't constantly put the blame on the world. You can't talk about, you know, complicity and think of Islamic Republic. Talk about brutality and just think about the world, from Palestine to Iraq to Darfur, you know. At some point, you have to say, that world, part of it is inside me, you know, and I have to not only confront it, but to give it a name by acknowledging it. There is a book which is rather different from mine, but I was reading Alice Sebald's Lucky. Her have you read her memoir? It is her memoir about being raped.
It's the book that came before her first novel.
It came before Lovely Bones. I told Alice, I didn't read Lovely Bones because it became, you know, like my book, a bestseller. But Lucky is a very interesting book because one night she's walking in the park and this guy, and she's a virgin, and he rapes her brutally and beats her and batters her. And she said that from that moment on, everybody who looked at her identified her with that act. Her parents, her sister, her schoolmates. That rapist had taken away her identity. She had now become a victim of the rape. Like in the Islamic Republic, when I come from there, I am not a woman. I am a Muslim woman coming from that country. Your identity is stolen. It's the identity theft. And she sets out to take back her name. That is the important thing. She goes after the rapist, and she writes a gorgeous poem, actually, I don't have it here with me, where she addresses her rapist and says that, if I could find you, and she goes on telling him what she will do, and she says, you will no more be my rapist. I will give you a name. You will be John or Luke or Paul. The fact is that the world is cruel, and the cruelest of all is not just a tyrannical regime. We are every moment facing death, and we can do nothing about it, except through memory, except through making conclusive evidence that we have lived despite the fact that we will not live forever. You know, and that is why you write. And my mother, her main problem there, and Alice both names her rapist and renames herself. She says, they were all telling the story about me, and it was time for her to make the story hers. And that is how you change your status from a victim to someone who is, I'm sorry, I should joke here, as Seinfeld would say, master of his own domain, you know, because you take your name back. And my mother, I now empathize with her so much because her mother died. The only thing she remembered of her mother was the night her mother died. My grandmother did not exist because no one remembered anything about her. No one could tell us what color her eyes were. How did she hold her, my mother? Did she make a favorite food? Did she love the color blue? That is how people become real. And my grandmother remained an absence, an void. And she married a man who was the prime minister's son at the time, beautiful, handsome, and in love with her, who did not tell her that he had a terminal disease and he would die soon. And the doctor had told the family, let him do whatever he wants because he doesn't have much to live. And he married her without telling her. And so she had this void. And she became frozen in the past. She couldn't articulate her void, her bitterness, her grief. So she turned against us. Once, my brother used to say that once she met our father, she was already lost to us. You know, because then, like Gatsby, you try to impose that frozen past on the present. You are asking your second husband, who's tender to you and who wants to love you, why aren't you the first? And she tried to give me everything she didn't have, because like many women in the 50s in America and in the 60s and in the 90s and in the 2000s, she was an in-between woman, a woman who had a great deal of potential, but her potentials were never fulfilled publicly. And she was unrealized. My Aunt Mina used to say, another intelligent woman gone to waste, you know. And because of that, she wanted me to be independent. She would stay up at nights to make me to study. That was her own goal. But she resented me because I had a mother that she didn't have. You know, she resented me for everything that she gave me. And she resisted me. And I resisted her back. I'm sorry I'm talking so much about this, but the whole idea is that my mother didn't know how to reclaim her name through living with the past and coming out of it. My country has done the same thing. It has not created a conversation with the past. This regime has imposed the past. And those of us who are fighting it, a lot of time we're fighting it with another past. But you need a creative conversation, and you need to write and articulate any way you can in order to move ahead.
I want to point out that it's also a matter of reclaiming the language. That Alice Sebold book called Lucky is called that because after she was raped, the police said, "You're lucky you weren't killed." And she wanted to re-own Lucky and give it back its own meaning. And also, I want to point out that a detail in writing begins with something you were once perhaps embarrassed by. My grandmother had lived through the American Depression, and so having things for free were very important to her. And so she would go out, and from the good humor man, the ice cream man, she would get from him packages of napkins, good humor napkins, which meant at our dinner table, all of our napkins had tiny holes in the center for the popsicle stick. And I remember she would go out on the porch and say to the good humor man, because she didn't walk very fast, she'd yoo-hoo at him and say, "Good humor, do you have something for me?" Meaning a package of napkins. And for the longest time, I would be so embarrassed that our, you know, dinner table napkins, breakfast napkins, were good humor napkins. And now it's my story about my grandmother, and it's unforgettable. If you live without reclaiming your language, you stay embarrassed by what happened to you. The moment you realize, oh, it's a story. In fact, it's the only story I have. It's my story. That's when you start loving writing and becoming a writer.
The whole idea of change comes through, I mean, Bello used to say that we live twice, once in reality and once when we talk about that reality, when we articulate that reality through our imagination. So through language, you're constantly renaming and reclaiming reality, and through changing that reality, you're changing yourself. You know, and that is why it is so important for us to remember that this country's language is the language of Twain, the language of Emily Dickinson, and not the language of O'Reilly and Obermann. I mean, you do realize what is happening to us. You do realize the way that sleeping consciousness is creeping up on us when you become so polarized, you know, that you lose all contact with your own reality. And if in our English departments, as you mentioned time and again, if in our English departments, instead of reconnecting us to life through the best that, you know, through the way we imagined, the way we lived, and the way we will live, if they do not teach us that, and instead of that, they teach us abstractions, we become by and by invisible. We fade away, you know. That is, not only will those books fade away, because books are like hothouse flowers, they constantly need to be reread and reinterpreted through different eyes, but we will fade away. We as know ourselves will fade away. And I think this is far more serious than we give it credit for. Why do we constantly have to lose something in order to gain it again, you know, in order to mourn for it? And that is where the language is going. That is why we need in every city many town hall meetings where we will be reading poetry out loud to one another. And for heaven's sake, let's forget about that ego, those egotistical critics who constantly tell us how to feel, how to connect, what to read, what not to read. We really need to get back to what poetry was made for, you know. Read Conrad again. He's really not an imperialist, I promise. Yeah. I mean, may I do something?
Yes, of
because
course.
Because I think that every talk about my book, I mean, I have the honor of being with Michael, but every talk about my book, I don't think it should be about promoting my book, but it should be promoting the idea of books. Because if you like my book, you'll finally will read it. And it should be about a celebration of other authors. This Polish exile writer, Witold Gombrowicz, is talking about what literature is all about, and he is directing it to the Stalinists at his time. And
is this from Ferdydirk? Is this from Ferdydirk?
It is from his diaries. And he says, "Our voice is the voice of a man made of flesh and blood. This is the individual voice. Not an idea, but a personality is important to us. We do not become real in the realm of concepts, but in the realm of people. We are, and we must remain persons. Our role depends on the fact that the living human word not stop sounding in a world that is becoming more and more abstract." And he says, what would happen if you liquidated art, communists? Nothing, you say. human progress would not be hindered. There would not be a void. No science, no silence. The loud voices of science, philosophy, the party, maybe even of religion, would still ring out. Surely, but are you really prepared for one major sacrifice? From then on, there would be no way of knowing what a man thinks or feels, what the individual man thinks or feels. Democracy is about this community of individuals, community of voices. Are we ready to take the risk to deprive ourselves of this community of voices? You know, this is what is at stake, the individual voice vanishing into the void because we let it. And so I think we have a far more serious war than the economic war. And this president is a writer. He wrote about shame. He wrote about how he wrote about his own shame in his first memoir. So let's take advantage and remind him that he's also a writer.
I want to point out that was a quote from Gombrowicz. He was a great Polish writer. I happened to read Gombrowicz because it turned out that the great Nobel Prize winner, Czesław Miłosz, who had been living for many years unknown in Berkeley before he was rediscovered by a Nobel Prize. You know, writers tend to love other writers, and Miłosz told me, oh, Gombrowicz, he is the funniest writer in Polish. He was my childhood friend. We grew up together. And really, you know, books travel. This is the global TomTom network. Susan Sontag calls me. She's met Nazar Afisi. And she says, Michael, have you read Hedayat? Do you know a novel, The Blind Owl? The Blind Owl had been sitting on my shelf. It was published by Grove Press in the late 50s. You know, Grove Press back then published some very racy books. If you know, Black Cat editions. Whoa! Among these racy books was a novel, a pornographic novel, by the great poet Apollinaire, The 100,000 Virgins. The Blind Owl had been sitting on my shelf unread for around 15 years until I got that call from Susan Sontag. Because when Susan Sontag calls you and says, have you read The Blind Owl? You want to be able to say yes. And I said, I'll call you back this afternoon. And I read The Blind Owl, 130 pages, very dark, you understand. The darkness of the imagination of the torturers of Iran when you read a novel like The Blind Owl. Its author committed suicide in Paris way before the revolution, but still I think his eyes were not blind and saw something. But that is what happens in these town hall meetings. Read poetry to one another. When you hear a quote that you like, go and get the book, you know. Find your quote from that book and give it to someone else. Share it. Every time you hear about a book that sounds interesting, buy it. Own more books than you can possibly read. Yes? Yes, you know what I mean, don't you? Because that way, bookstores won't close. And, you know, go to the library all the time. You know, return your books on time, I think. What do you think? Return your books on time.
But, you know, that is, I mean, there are many different levels of connection. There are people you love and you meet in life. And then there is a very special connection that you get through books. And my writing of my book, it was so amazing because ghosts would appear in the meetings. Like right now, my best friend Farzaneh and Farhad from Oklahoma just appeared. And you know, as she was coming in and you were talking, and I kept looking and looking and looking, and you know, and all of these people from the past that crop up both in my memory, and And in reality, it is because I wrote a book and then somebody said, oh, she's alive and she's somewhere around here. And we found ourselves, you know, one another. And you talk about the Iranian culture. And that is, I want to tell you, they're both Iranians and Americans here, and something that really hurts. I've been called all sorts of names because I criticize this regime, and I talk about it, you know, like for me, marriage at the age of 9 for women is not my culture. For me, stoning women or men for adultery and prostitution is not my culture, because I feel if that is my culture, then segregation is the culture of this country. Until 1950s, the restaurants and the buses in this country were segregated. When did the American women gain the right to vote? Did Susan Cady and Cady Stanton live to see American women vote in 1920? What were they calling Cady Stanton and Susan B. Anthony and Harriet Beecher Stowe? They were saying that Bible says a woman's place is at home. That you should not be doing this. So if that is my culture, then Inquisition and fascism and Stalinism is the culture of Europe, and not Goethe or St. Thomas Aquinas or St. Augustine or Flaubert. So the whole idea is that when I think about my culture, when I think about the continuity of my culture, I go from Rudaki to Ferdowsi to Rumi to Hafez, and I think this is how we used to have a dialogue. Goethe would fall in love with Hafez and translate Hafez. Ralph Waldo Emerson would fall in love with Sa'di. Dick Davis now in Ohio State is falling in love with Ferdowsi and Gorgani. And that is how we exchange culture. We really have to fight this ideological, politicized culture that thinks of a country, and the smirking face of President Ahmadinejad comes to its, is America Mr. Bush? America is both Mr. Bush and Mr. Obama. America is also something that neither Bush nor Obama would reject, is Twain and Bellow and Wallace Stevens and W.S. Merwin. This is the America you want my students in Iran to know. Is it too much to ask that when you think of Iran, not to think of Khatami or Ahmadinejad, but to think of those 70 million people coming from different backgrounds, different ethnicities, different religions? Is it too much to ask to say that, no, life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness is not an American thing? It is not American women who want to be happy. Honest to God, that woman in Afghanistan who is taken to a football stadium and executed because of the way she dresses, she wants to be happy. That woman in Saudi Arabia or Iran doesn't like to be flogged. They don't go to their death being stoned saying, oh, it's my culture. You know, that is what bothers me. And now in Iran, you know, I talk about it in my book, it has become theater of absurd. You show Sir Laurence Olivier's Othello, but you cut Desdemona from most scenes, and you cut Othello's suicide because the basses will be depressed to watch Sir Laurence Olivier commit suicide on the screen. They won't be, depressed, being stoned to death. They say, well, that's our culture. You know, we can't help that. But they don't like him. Or you know, in children's stories, they put the veil on the drawings of female chickens so that the male chickens would not be aroused. I mean, what kind of a sick mind would call this religion? Anyone who is a Muslim would, not an atheist, not a Zoroastrian, not a Baha'i, not a Christian, not a Jew, but a Muslim would stand up against this sort of view of Islam. A man who cannot look at me like this, who will be aroused and has to go and do something about it, attack me or kill himself, should be in a mental hospital, should not be in the streets. You know, so the whole idea that if I say these things, I become an Israeli and CIA agent, you know, I accept it. because somebody should say that this is not the way to look at the world. This is not the way to look at yourselves. This is not the way to look at other people. This is demeaning. This is condescending. This is not giving Iranian people their due and their culture. Far better to criticize this culture than, because criticism means accountability, means that you really take the other person seriously and you think that they should not be the way they are. Far better to think that right now, the Nobel laureate Shirin Ebadi, because of, you know, the way she has been supporting the 1 million signature that Iranian women have been asking against the repressive laws, she has been attacked by vigilantes day and night. And when Israel attacked Palestine, they sent vigilantes to her home to attack her, to you know, throw stones at her, to ask for her execution, and called her an Israeli agent. These are the things you don't hear on television because Larry King is busy asking Mr. Ahmadinejad, do you like New York? I tell you, he's far more popular in New York than he is in Tehran.
Larry King is famous in America for explaining that he does not like to read the books by guests on his show because it will make him a better interviewer.
Well, yeah, we have to finish.
We're going to open up to the audience.
We love monopolizing.
Yes,
despite
yes.
Our love of democracy.
So will you raise your hand and let's applaud.
Who will be taking the questions? I'm very bad with it, but
I'll call. Yes. I'll call on people. Yes.
I'm Penelope, and I taught English in Turkey to Turkish girls in Greece and in Thailand. And I wonder if any of the, and read your book, I wonder if you were in contact with any of the girls that you read, they read Lolita in Tehran and what they're doing with their lives.
Well, one girl, Azin, I think she's married to her fourth husband now, but this time happily. And she lives in the Bay Area, and she's both studying and teaching. One girl and the guy who I call Nima, they're in Washington, D.C. now. And one is in Canada, one is in Germany, one is still in Iran. So they're scattered all around the world. Mahshid, who's in Iran, she used to call me on my birthdays and New Year, but she hasn't done that. I think she might have lost it because we changed address, or I got too old, and she thought she better not remind me. But they are well, I think.
Who's next?
There's someone up there. Where?
Yes.
Yes, who? The gentleman.
They're handing out the microphone. Oh, I see. I thought, okay. Yes, right there.
Could you raise your hand?
Raise your hand. Are there no questions?
We put you guys to sleep, didn't
no,
we?
No, please. There you are. Thank you.
First of all, thank you for being here to have the conversation with us. I was struck by the story you told about receiving Nabokov's Ada, and you saying that as a literary critic, you didn't feel as though you could bring in the...
I didn't what?
As a literary critic, you didn't feel as though you could bring in the, sort of the personal aspect, and I was wondering if that was sort of a greater commentary on academia and sort of a privileging of the work as some sort of abstraction versus our own dialogue and our own sort of preface to it, and if that's sort of part and parcel of your critique of the lack of imagination and sensuality, etc.
You know, in Iran also, I think with more justification than here because there's more access here, one thing was with the regime because nothing that was personal. I mean, if you live under a system that tells you how to look, how to appear in public even, then it would be far more difficult to write about whom you fall in love with. That was one aspect of it, but that wasn't all. I think something much deeper, we can't blame the regime for everything. There was something deeper in the intellectual culture that was in love with big names. As long as I was writing about the Russian formalists and talking about Jakobson and Shklovsky, who are, by the way, fantastic, and I think they're just great, I was accepted as a serious critique. When I would start not mentioning or quoting them, talking on my own or becoming playful, I once wrote an essay about literature as play. And I was attacked ferociously by someone who said, literature is not a game, you bitch, you know. Literature is serious, you know, and this shows the frivolousness of this person who talks in this manner. So it was the same way about personal, revealing, airing your dirty laundry, it is called. You know, you can talk about the loftiest ideas and turn them into something cliché and vulgar. And you can talk about the most vulgar experiences and turn them into something beautiful and lofty, you know. So I also think that we need to challenge that idea about the triviality of the personal, you know.
Hands. Yes, over there.
And there. Oh, that lady also had her hand.
Okay.
As an undergraduate, I majored in English literature. And when I graduated, I felt that because I was a divorced mother with two children to raise entirely on my own, I felt that the only possible career path I could take was to go to law school. So I took myself up to Berkeley and went to law school and spent the bulk of my working life as a lawyer. And I didn't really want to do that, but it was the only way I could make enough money to support my family. I felt that I couldn't pursue any other avenue while I was working in the law. And so it's been a long time before I could spend more time in literature. And I'd like to hear your comments about the feeling of the issue of women having to pursue literature later in life.
You know, one good thing about literature is that you can pursue it without pursuing it. Because you can always read after you come back from you know, whatever it is that you do. And I'm sure, don't you think that your passion or your love or your interest in literature resonate in what you do as a lawyer? I think that is what literature is. My daughter is now in med school, but when she was getting her BA, she kept saying she loved literature and she wanted to double major in English Lit and neurobiology. And I told her what Nabokov used to say, you need to have the passion of the scientist. No, the passion of the scientist and the precision of the poet, you know. And so whatever field you choose, literature can be always your field, I feel. But I know that does not substitute for women who want to do one thing and then they are forced to do another thing. Maybe we hope that our daughters would not have to do that. You know. Well,
yes.
You made reference to things that are not part of the culture of Iran or other Muslim countries. And I'm wondering, because certain things, events do take place, actions on the part of the masses do take place. And
you're right, yeah.
I have a hard time understanding how you would say that that's not cultural. And if it is something you don't want to be or regard as cultural, how do you change it so it is not cultural?
No, you're right, and I'm glad you mentioned that, because both the good and the bad, I mean, every culture is capable of the best and the worst, and no culture is immune from those aspects that we as people commit. And definitely any government that has come to Iran is not solely guilty. We brought them to power, you know, and we should be responsible. I think that this country is the best example of you can change, because 100 years ago, women did not have the right to vote, and this country was segregated. Now, not only do we have Hillary Clinton, whom we expect, I mean, she's a symbol of a woman who has fought all her life, but we have Sarah Palin. Isn't it interesting that if it weren't for Betty Friedan and Gloria Steinem, you wouldn't be having Sarah Palin, would you? You know, because now women have reached a point where you have the first dude who's a conservative. He stays at home. And when you judge a woman, you're not judging it by, you know, whether she's a woman or a man, but what ideology she has. You vote for her, hopefully, the way you vote for a man, you know. So I think that that is how things change, not by politicians, but by things becoming unacceptable for the people. In my country, the government claims that this is about religion. It isn't about religion. My grandmother wore the veil all her life. She never took it off. But her grandchildren, some of them like me, never wore the veil. My mother considered herself a Muslim, never wore the veil, but went to pilgrimage to Mecca. Veil should be a personal choice and not a symbol of the state. That is what is wrong. It should be because you have faith and you want to, you know, take on the veil, not because you oppose the Shah or are pro-Khomeini. And I think that now in my country, I think Iranian people are learning to do that, learning to understand that this is a matter of choice. And I think that this country has done it well. For me, Martin Luther King is a good example, or the women, Elizabeth Cady Stanton is a good example, and not the politicians who hijack the rights later on.
Hello, thank you. I have a personal question. Given the number of comments that were made about the sensuality of reading and that sort of digestive process, where's your favorite place to read?
Bed.
Actually, I cannot sleep without reading. I read myself to sleep. I'm very promiscuous about books. First of all, I have no favorites because there are so many, you know, from Raymond Chandler to Rumi, they're all favorites. And I don't think that there is a corner in our house where I have not read. But I usually lay back and read. I never can read in a sitting position unless I'm in a plane. And you do really read in bed?
Well, I used to tell people, you know, because a lot of people would ask me about studying, and you can't really study in bed. It won't work.
I do. I write in bed.
But now, for me, I do. I read in bed. I like to let the books I'm reading tumble into my dreams. I often go back 50 pages in the morning to find out what was on the page and what was in my dream. But I like the idea, you know, I don't think Don Quixote, given what we live in now, what reality is like now, I don't mind having a mind besotted by books. I really feel that what I've learned there is what I have to give, that my gift was being a sponge to book after book after book. I liked them. I found the world very painful and find it so still. But the human imagination seems glorious to me, and I like its products, you know. I like them better than textiles or iron ores. And the products of the imagination, I'm very happy to fall asleep and have the book continue behind my eyes. It's a real thing for me.
Thank you.
Thank you all.
Aloud Audio is presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles and made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the Annenberg Foundation, City National Bank, contributors to the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and Donna and Martin J. Wolf. Media support provided by KUSC 91.5 FM and KCET. Aloud theme composed by Larry Karish.